time for Truth About Markets London with Max and Stacey.
Hello, London. You know, just to warn you that you must savor this episode as much as you can, because apparently Resonance will be closed for the next 3 Saturdays after this, so you will not be hearing from us.
That's right. This is it for 3 weeks. Everyone's going on break. The big summer break. So I guess we should turn to what's happening in the world. So what do you want to talk about?
Well, we have unemployment in the U.S. We have fires surrounding Moscow. Now they're trying to protect the actual Kremlin itself from catching on fire.
Mm-hmm.
There's floods in Pakistan. There's another alleged gaffe by David Cameron. There's
okay. Let's talk about the Cameron gaffe. That's fun.
He, I guess, was standing with Zardari, the prime minister of Pakistan, and said, you know, we need to help Turkey and Pakistan because Iran has a nuclear weapon. So now everybody's like, oh, he says that Iran actually has a nuclear weapon. And, and he was saying, no, it was a gaffe. I didn't mean to say that.
Right. What do we make about all this?
Well, he could just be, you know, it could have been an intentional gaffe.
Mm-hmm.
To make people for those headlines.
Mm-hmm.
Iran has a nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could just be he's tired and gaffe prone, as most people are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it doesn't really mean much. You know, domestically, they're at home. They're going ahead with various what they call austerity measures.
Mm-hmm.
They cut out film financing completely, right?
Well, they removed the UK Film Council.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Which is a positive and negative. Negative in that it did help finance many well-known films, but also many very unknown films, like helped a lot of young filmmakers. I worked with them in the past on projects.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, there is a very small clique, a group, a clique, as we call it in America. The Loveys. There are a small group of people that do control all of the access to these sort of funds.
Right. So there might be less Lovey Film Council chatter at Groucho Club.
Well, but it could be difficult if you've, for some reason, offended a minor aristocrat, they would have a lot of pull in these art council sort of lovey things.
Mm-hmm.
So you would be excluded from all possible funding.
Right. So it's interesting, of course, you know, we're back in the film space, film finance space with Pirate My Film, of course. And to look at different markets around the world, you know, we were looking at Nollywood, which is really... I really didn't follow up on Nollywood at all. Of course, it sounds like Bollywood, which is taken from that word that was created to mimic Hollywood, and Bollywood, of course, being in India. But Nollywood is another country with another big film market and another interesting model. Tell the people.
Yeah, it is quite interesting. Nollywood is Nigeria's film market, and it's the second biggest one in the world. They make over 2,000 films a year, and the average film costs between $17,000 and $30,000 US dollars, and it takes a week to make, and on average, they sell between 150,000 and 200,000 DVDs that day, the very first day. It becomes like a big release. Everybody wants to get the DVD. I guess it doesn't go out in cinemas, but is released on DVD.
Right.
And there's huge demand, and it's a flourishing market. It's billions of dollars every year.
Right. Now, I noticed the DVD market in the U.S. is crumbling. They just reported the DVD sales for the last quarter, and for the trailing 12 months, they were down sharply again. So DVD sales peaked, I guess, about 2 years ago, and this was really driving Hollywood in a lot of ways. The Walmart DVD sales, I think they were reported every Tuesday, and this would have a huge impact on the fortunes of producers and independent producers in Hollywood and in the U.S., but DVD sales are crumbling, I would imagine, because everything is migrating over to the web.
Well, that's right, but also the Hollywood market, again, like I've worked in that, it's a giant, giant sucking accounting fraud machine. So you have very well-paid executives. Hundreds will have worked on one single film that will take 10 years to make. And that one film, the box office has to pay for thousands of meals and dozens of trips to Cannes and Venice and other film festivals around the world. So every single film has to pay for all of that related, entertainment involved in that film. Whereas, say, with this Nollywood model, think about it. So if they're the high-end films that cost $30,000, mm-hmm. and you're selling 150 to 200,000 DVDs the first day, right. You know, selling it at 50 cents, you double your investment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's a manufacturing model. They're manufacturing films, and they're making money on every unit. Whereas the Hollywood model is they know they're going to lose money on every ticket sold at the theater. But that is part of the model. The model is really an accounting model where the losses are amortized over 30 years and the profits are taken in the immediate quarter. So you have companies with huge balance sheets that are made up largely of debt, and you have the top executives milking the cream off the top with anything that does well. You know, 1 out of 10 movies, let's say, will be a hit. And those profits go immediately to the executives. The other 9 losers are amortized over 20, 30 years. The balance sheet gets bloated with debt, and then they declare bankruptcy. So you see this with film companies like Carol Co. and the whole history of independent film producers in Hollywood.
Well, it's a genuine feudal model. It's not a business to make profit. It's a business. It's a toll booth to finance a lifestyle. In Hollywood.
Yeah, it's also a loss leader. So you take a company like Disney, they make money on theme parks and they make money on merchandise. And so they're diversified. And this is what, you know, the big studios are diversified over theme parks and merchandise and other areas. And the films themselves are considered loss leaders. They're considered to be something we give away every weekend to promote the franchise, to promote the merchandise and the tie-ins with the restaurants and the theme parks. So it's... They don't really expect to make money on the films. If any film does make money, it's a bit of a shock.
It's also, they're expecting a loss because it's financing their lifestyle. But I remember when I was working in Hollywood, it would be, at that time, the record industry actually made a lot of money, a lot of profit. And so that's what, like, Columbia Pictures owned Columbia Records. And all the profits from Columbia Records would be written off against the massive losses that would be guaranteed in the film industry.
Right. Again, accounting trickery, accounting methodology, the so-called Hollywood accounting, which was really pioneering in its use of consolidated balance sheets and special purpose entity accounts, which were the films themselves. Now, flash forward to Enron, circa 2000 and so, and here you have a company with hundreds and hundreds of off-balance sheet special purpose entity accounts, which had, remember, famously names like Chuko and other characters from big films like Star Wars.
Yeah.
And they were used in the same way. They dumped all the risk in these off-balance sheet accounts that never saw the light of day. They were never consolidated in their quarterly earnings reports. They kept reporting record profits because they never showed any of the debts until such time as the $80 billion company was marked down to zero, because all the debt had to be marked to market in one flail swoop, and that was the end of Enron. And this is not gone away. It's been more finessed in terms of what we see at Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan. They've kind of refined the model because there's been no regulation to stop it. The Sarbanes-Oxley bill, which was supposed to counter the Enron abuses, that's been more or less watered out of existence. And the new technologies using high-frequency trading and other algorithmic trading are able to create this Enron-style, Hollywood-style accounting more subtly. And again, way ahead of the regulators and the SEC and the FSA to keep track of it. And that's what the Wall Street crowd has been able to do, is to stay one step ahead of the sheriff. But they're reinventing basically the same model, which is this basic accounting fraud of keeping your debts out of view. We saw it with Bernie Madoff. We saw it with any Ponzi scheme, any pyramid selling scheme. It's basically the same idea. It's just different flavors, different ways to cook the books, but the idea is basically the same.
Well, in Nollywood, most of the films, almost all of them, are religious films, surprisingly. There are very few action films or cop films or horror films. It's all about, it's quite evenly divided there. It's either 50% of the population is, or close to it, is a Muslim. The other half is Christian. But they also have a lot of evangelical Christian films. And half of them are, Muslim films.
So this is interesting. So you're saying that people are buying DVDs of religious films. So what constitutes a religious film exactly?
Religious themes like, Jesus being born or religious epiphanies or Virgin Mary, or I don't know what the Muslim ones are about.
So as a category, in the U.S., this category doesn't really exist, except for maybe Mel Gibson's Passion of Christ or Martin Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ. The religion is a theme in probably less than 2% of the output.
Of Hollywood, yeah.
Of Hollywood. Yeah. Now here you're saying it's 99% of the output.
Yeah, but like you said, you mentioned Mel Gibson's film, and that made huge amounts of money, but they also, all those Left Behind series of books, all those evangelical, there's loads of evangelical books. There's a huge industry in America. So it does seem kind of weird that Hollywood hasn't made, tapped into that market. But that just shows you, though, it's just funding a lifestyle. It's nothing about business. It's not actually about making money.
Right. Well, so I'm just trying to get a handle on the pop culture experience of a Nigerian person. So that Saturday night, they've worked all week, they pop in a DVD, and they're going to watch a two-hour religious film.
This is apparently, I think it's kind of like, in Bollywood, a lot of those films are about Hindu myths or, stories from old texts, yeah. Ancient texts there.
Right.
But they jazz it all up, they sing some songs, they do things like that. I haven't seen a Nollywood film, but I believe this is what it's like. It's more entertaining, musical version of certain religious parables or texts.
Mm-hmm. So if I were in Nigeria and I produced a film about two Nigerian cops caught in a drug trade triangle, it would bomb at the box office because it's not a religious theme. Essentially,
well,
is what we're saying.
Perhaps it might not be allowed to be released. I'm not sure what the religious laws are there, like in terms of inspiring sort of, forbidden thoughts and
mm-hmm.
naughty entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a huge market. The price that it costs to make a film is incredible. Of course, on Pirate My Film, the budget sizes are between $5,000 and $15,000, so roughly in the Nollywood ballpark, give or take. The idea is, as the community scales up in size, then the budget collar will be increased. But until the community size starts to get bigger, it doesn't make any sense to offer $500,000 or $1 million budgeted film if you've got 1,000 people on the site.
Yeah, but Nollywood proves that you don't need it. I mean, this is pretty consistent. Their budgets aren't increasing. And in fact, the articles you read about Nollywood, it is a lot of people are being attracted. They're coming to Africa because there is the know-how. There are lots of cameramen and people there who know how to make films like this. And,
uh-huh.
and so there is a way to do it as a mass production that isn't just financing the lifestyles of the feudal you know, copyright owners.
So I assume they're using like high def video.
I'm sure there's over 2,000 films a year made. I'm sure there's some done in high 8, some done on super 8, some done on 16, some done in black and white, some done in color, some done in HD, some done on handheld.
You know, my question is, I'm just curious, what would be the high selling camera in that area? With so many different cameras on offer, what's the camera of choice, you know, for the young Nollywood filmmaker? Like, oh, I want to make a film. I want to get my hands on a blank, blank, blank. I mean, I wonder what the popular camera is.
I don't know. If anybody out there knows, send us.
What would you think? What's your camera preference? You're a filmmaker.
Well, I don't know. I tend to use that. We tend to use a Sony. We used to use the Sony Z1. But now we use the Panasonic P2 system.
Yeah, tell the people about the Panasonic P2 system.
I like the colors. They have very rich colors. It's an HD camera. And it shoots in very, very rich colors. The Sony Z1 is not so good with colors. It bleaches out often. Like, it can't deal with sunlight, really. It becomes too unstable.
And it's got the cards.
Oh, the P2 system has the cards, yes. It doesn't record to tape. It records directly just to a digital data, which is good in a way because it's kind of fast and convenient, but it does leave you a little bit panicked because, you know, digital data can just disappear. Your computer crashes and all your data is gone, and then you like, oops, I don't have a tape to recapture that.
Right. And of course, you don't have to download then you don't have to digitize the tape because it's already being digitized while you shoot, right? That's a time sink, hasn't it, Anna?
That's correct.
So you're shooting in the digital in the card, you pop the card out, it goes into the laptop, and you can start editing right away. And presumably you can make a backup somewhere online. I'm sure there's backup digital storage sites. They can back up a card right away. Cost of storage, of course, is dropping.
Yeah, I mean, Google's starting to offer something like that, but it is, remember, it's HD, so it is a very big file. So a half hour of material will be like, oh, I don't know, you know, 9, 10 gigabytes.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. So like on PirateMyFilm.com, we could offer users, members of the site, for example, if they wanted to pay a monthly subscription, we could offer them a warehouse, storehouse for digital downloads. Resell that service to them somehow.
Yeah, that would have to cost extra right now. I mean, it costs a lot to, you know, have those servers. Those servers are what's expensive. That's why Google has those giant server farms because it just...
Yeah, no, we'd buy it wholesale from a big server farm and re-offer it on a retail basis and maybe make a 10% markup. And but to our as a service to the members, so they would be out there in the field capturing 1, 2, 3 hours of digital tape on a P2 card. They could quickly download that and store it in some online storage, and then get back to editing it when they had time to edit it. But they'd have a backup copy.
Well, this is what Nollywood does. Nollywood does not use like Final Cut Pro to edit something on, which is what I have, and it costs thousands of dollars to buy this program. Mm-hmm. There are free services to edit a film available online. You could download them. You can, you know, it's free systems, and they use these free systems to edit.
Yeah, I just found on Friday a site that offers free budgeting templates. So, you know, when you're budgeting a film, you have to account for the cost breakdown for the props and the clothes and the food and stuff. So, I found a guy who worked it all up and made a free version available. So we're going to plug that into the Pirate My Film site so that members can budget their film. So when you go to the project page, there'll be a link to the budget page. So then the producers can input that information and then change it on the fly, and then all the community, of course, can view that, and they get a sense of what the budget is all about and where it's going. And so again, it's just adding.
This is a budgeting thing for those who haven't made a film with Hollywood sort of people. It costs thousands of dollars to get a line producer sort of person to write a budget for you. It's a very expensive thing. All these things add up. You've got to pay for their lifestyle as well. So there is that. There's also, you have to write the script, and it does, if obviously you can write it anyway if you're not going to send it around, but you know, people do use Final Draft, for example, which is one program that you can write your script on, and that will cost what I think it's like $300 for the software program. But there are now several online options for free, which are script formatting. And it does it for you for free, and it stores your script online for free. So
is Scribe one of them?
No, that's not correct. There's Scribe is a service where you can upload documents like PDFs and you know, Word documents that are then shared globally online. Mm-hmm. But there is, it's something similar to Scribe. I forget the name of it, but I'll post it on our site, maxkaiser.com.
So you can put it on piratemyfilm.com.
Or piratemyfilm.com.
The traffic is just exploding on the site. And it's becoming more valuable now because of news of the past few days of the deal pending between Google and Verizon. So Google and Verizon looks like they're doing a deal which would turn the internet more into a cable TV model where you've got free TV and then you've got pay TV. And you pay monthly subscription, bundling together different packages of cable TV. And, of course, the quote-unquote good stuff ends up costing a lot of money. And in the internet space, of course, this will be interesting because of two things. Number one, the speed issue. And number two, the virtual currency and credits issue. So on the speed issue, the money that is being collected through subscriptions for the cable TV modelization of the internet would go toward upgrading the infrastructure and speed of those providing the premium content. And of course, in the US, which is now not in the top 30 anymore in terms of speed on the internet, this has always been the conjecture that this was done on purpose, basically, because they don't want to give people in the US the premium internet experience because they want to be able to charge for it like cable TV. So it then shows that, like democracynow.org, which are independent news sources, of course, they would be relegated to the slow internet and just below the average speed of the person not on the premium channel, so that it would become very tedious to view that program. And of course, they would lose a big part of their audience, which is very self-serving to the people who are putting out the premium content. And then on the virtual currency and credit size, you know, there's a lot of movement now in virtual currencies. This company, Zynga, is getting a lot of press. They've got that deal, of course, with 7-Eleven and Farmville, where you can convert your Facebook credits and virtual Zynga points into credits that are usable to buy stuff at 7-Eleven. They've got another big campaign now in New York City for their game Mafia Wars, where they're plastering cars all over the East Village with fake shattered windshield decals with an ad to MafiaWars.com. So they're, you know, moving into the analog space or the meat space with this digital currency, which brings us back to the big question, of course, as always, has to do with the global banking system and the Federal Reserve banking system and the ability to print money, not print money. Should you be able to print money? In a book that's been highly discussed in the past few weeks that was published in Germany in the 1920s, talking about hyperinflation in Weimar Germany, talking about how when the government, when it tried to stop the runaway hyperinflation, was stopped printing money. But the corporations, who of course need consumers to keep paying their Christmas bonuses, started printing money themselves. The corporations simply printed money. And now we're seeing this in the U.S., even though there's a credit crunch and a credit crisis, and the Fed is desperately trying to restart the engines, and they can't do it. Companies themselves are simply printing money. Facebook is getting ready to print Facebook currency dollars. Zynga, with a virtual currency, is just printing money. And of course, a virtual dollar is about as useful as the fiat dollar. They're both collateralized by nothing. It's just a concept, a construct. But people can use it as a mechanism of exchange, and they can ultimately aggregate value through their participation by clicking on ads, etc. So we're heading toward this interesting new virtual currency world, which will supersede the fiat currency world and continue to, I think, apply what I would call deflationary pressure, really. But anyway, so this is the big banking question of the past few weeks. This, of course, is always the debate. And the Bank of England here in the UK, I believe they are talking about more quantitative easing, although the pound is certainly trading relatively okay versus other big trading economies.
Well, you know, they can print all their currency they want. If people don't want it, they're not going to take it. And that's going to cause the hyperinflation on the currency to collapse. I think with the internet, of course, they haven't yet asserted absolute control over that. And it is free. You are free to create your own currencies. We can create, as we have, the Pirate My Film currency or the MaxKaiser.com currency, which is a virtual currency, not backed by any government or FDIC. It's free, unencumbered by them and their debts and their feudal lifestyles. So I imagine as more and more people just start to collect Zynga dollars or Farmville dollars or Second Life dollars, eventually the government will take back their monopoly power. They will not want that. They will not want people to be able to create their own systems, free and independent of them. Because like we were talking about with the Hollywood feudal system where you're just paying the toll booth and supporting a lifestyle, that's what all our taxes are going towards. It's just going to our lifestyle to a few politicians, the military-industrial complex, and the bankers. It's just supporting a lifestyle. It's not providing any services. It's not doing anything. It's not creating any sort of community or society or system of wealth creation.
No. And I think that'll be an interesting development to watch. It will be a deal between, let's say, the Federal Reserve Bank and Zynga. So you've already got people in place like Timothy Geithner and Larry Summers and the gang from Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, etc., who, of course, you got another big company, an IPO coming out in the fall for Demand Media, which is another kind of virtual currency, virtual media play. And that's going to be the first $1 billion IPO since Google. And it'll make a few guys extraordinarily wealthy. But these types of companies now are politically in a position to make inroads onto the board of directors of the Federal Reserve Bank and Federal Open Market Committee in Washington. So I think that'll be an interesting development to see the Fed actually do a deal with a virtual gaming company to swap all the junk that they inherited during the last junk swap of 2008, somehow monetize that using these virtual currencies and try to launder it back into the system through the vast global casino that is developing thanks to virtual currency and virtual gaming. Otherwise, they're going to have to sit with that bad debt in perpetuity, and it does nothing for them. If there's a way they can leech it back into the system, and I think that through the virtual global gaming platform, they could leech it back into the system. I think, yeah, it'd be an interesting deal to cut. I mean, why not? You've got Geithner and the gang are pure Wall Street creatures. They're not public servants in any way. If they can help the fortunes of the listed companies that they're taking public and they have positions in, and Congress, of course, has huge positions in all the companies that they're supposed to be regulating, I think it would be an interesting deal to consider and an inevitable deal to consider. And I think this is what is not on the radar of folks like Paul Krugman, obviously, and others who are thinking in terms of Keynesian or non-Keynesian or various other models that really haven't been in force for decades in this new digital economy, virtual currency world that is engulfing and superseding everything that's come before it.
Yes, well, I think as the U.S. Federal Reserve was created in 1913 at the behest and demand of the J.P. Morgans of the world, I think you'll have the same situation develop with and the demand coming from the likes of Google, that they'll be demanding a creation of a special unit for virtual currencies, of which they will be the member banks that are have the exclusive right to issue it to the government, which then in turn will issue it to the population.
Absolutely. And it'll be all tied and embedded with advertising. So think of it this way. The pounds that you carry in your pocket would have, let's say, a holographic embed of an advertisement. So when you pull out a fiver at the pub, in your hand is the five-pound note plus an embedded holographic ad playing for Zynga or Farmville or Facebook. So every unit of exchange will have an ad embedded in it, since the cost of electrons is zero and there are an infinite number of them. And the cost of transmitting them over the internet is following that asymptotic curve to zero. The cost of storing them similarly down to zero. There will be nothing, no thought, no keystroke, no transaction that will be devoid of an advertisement. And so we will be reborn as a species into an advertisement.
We're living advertisements. Hey, I was reading about online media here, and there's, you know, there's a big discussion going on in the UK about paywalls, because of course Rupert Murdoch's Times has introduced a paywall. So of course the traffic to his site collapsed by over 90%. Now, they were talking about the big success story in the UK online is dailymail.co.uk. And they're trying to understand why it is that it's so successful. It gets a 4.8 million unique visitors per day.
Mm-hmm.
And over half of it is from the US and out the rest of the world. And they can't figure out how it's so successful. But it's quite obvious to me if you go to it. It's, first of all, compare it to, you know, go to mirror.co.uk or thesun.co.uk or telegraph or guardian.co.uk. And it's just very simple. Every single story has a photo and then one brief sentence explaining it. And of course, a catchy headline, every single one. And that's what, you know, it tells you all in just one pretty picture. Nobody else can understand why you go to these other sites and it's hard to navigate. You can't see what the stories are about. It's there's no picture to help identify what the story is about.
Mm-hmm. All right. So Times Online was free. It's owned by Rupert Murdoch.
That's correct.
Then they introduce a paywall and the traffic dropped 90%. The Daily Mail, who owns that one?
The Associated Media Group. I think it's called something. It's a you know, a guy. Guy and who owns okay. a big
the
corporation.
Guy,
it's not.
Guy.
He's not like.
It's not Murdoch though.
It's not Murdoch.
Okay. So and
Paul
it's,
Dacry, I think, was
got a paywall or no?
It has zero paywall.
Right.
You can
free.
Go to it free. There's nothing. You don't even have to register free.
Right. And so Murdoch with Times Online, he of course Times Online was getting huge traffic. You know, and but he decided that he wanted to bring in the paywall, but Times Online was getting traffic. And, of course, the sites that I remember this conversation, this something I was reading a couple of weeks ago. There are sites that are successfully behind a paywall, the Financial Times being one of them.
So the Financial Times is not behind a paywall. It's behind a registration wall. You have to register, and it's free.
Uh-huh. The content is limited. If you want full access, it costs money.
Okay. Well, I, you know, they gave my email address some sort of access. I'm able to read everything, a lot of things anyway. I haven't noticed any.
Uh-huh. So, let's see. Wall Street Journal, I believe that has a paywall.
That has a paywall. Yes.
Okay. So Wall Street Journal has a paywall and, that's owned by Murdoch now too.
That's correct. But obviously, all the banks, of course, provide that's nothing to them, whether it's $1,000 a year or $10,000 a year for the subscription.
Right, all that paywall is being underwritten by the public through the bailout.
Exactly.
So that's where the money comes from, the public. So it's Murdoch is living on the handouts from the government through the paywall of the Wall Street Journal that he's been bailed out of.
That's correct.
So, in other words, because I'm trying to get at this whole Murdoch thing, because to me, he just seems like an unbelievably overrated business person. Okay, here's a perfect example. To compete in a pitched battle, to compete on an open field with another company, he doesn't seem to be able to compete at all. So here you have the Wall Street Journal, which is subsidized by the government to create the paywall. Okay, he's making money on that, presumably, or doing something that's not losing money. But again, that's a protected welfare scheme for Murdoch. That's not an open battle. He's not competing. So then you take the Times of London, where he was free, but I guess he wasn't competing. It wasn't against the other sites like the.
Well, he was getting the traffic, but the thing is, and you could read it in it, just Google it yourself. Go look for the stories discussing why they introduced the paywall, and what you see over and over in his statements and his executive statements is contempt for peasants. They have contempt for people who think they can have something for free. And
while he's taking all this free
money. But it is he that lacks the imagination to figure out how to make money off that. Because obviously the Daily Mail has figured out a way to make money on it. They're making money.
They're competing.
Well, they're about to break even finally. You know, it took a while to set up the website and the traffic and the blah, blah, blah. But yeah, they're about to be in the black.
Right. So they're competing. So let's go over to the internet space. Murdoch took over MySpace, which at the time was becoming the Facebook of its day. It had a huge lead on everybody else. He took it over. He brought in huge amount of ads, like AOL level of over-advertising. And now it's relegated to the dustbin of history. So he blew that. That was $1 billion-plus complete waste.
Yes, that the traffic on MySpace has fallen by 50%. It was a situation where, you know, anytime you went to a MySpace thing, even on a Macintosh, it was just like everything would, you know, crash, screech to a halt. All your browsers collapsed, all these ads popped up. But it also had the problem of, I think, of kind of a chat roulette sort of thing. You know, where anybody could just post anonymously and create pictures and music and sound. You had all sorts of weird, you know, men, keto sort of weird guys on there.
Okay. So he can't compete in social networking. He destroyed a $1 billion franchise. He can't compete with free online media, and his pay media is subsidized by the taxpayer vis-a-vis the bailout. He owns Fox TV, Fox, and movie pictures, right? So he's got the studio, the Fox studio, which, that seems to be hit or miss business. I guess
they had a big year this year. They just announced their earnings. It was like a $3 billion profit. And I forget which film it was, but it was like Avatar or something like that, which mm-hmm. they released and made a lot of money.
Right, so you've got the Fox News, Fox TV. I think they did 24, I think, was Fox.
Yeah.
And that's been wrapped up business lately. He's got the satellite TV, of course. That's a monopoly. So, again, that's not open competition. That's a monopoly. So, at three out of the four business units that just described, the monopoly of the satellites, the subsidy of the paywall of the Wall Street Journal, and the failure to get into social networking has been an abject failure. Now, the movie business, it's a hit or miss business, and he's got that happening. I guess the titles, the backlog of titles are throwing off some kind of
He's been definitely successful at propaganda. He's good at he's definitely good at creating genuine fear and panic and stampedes in a certain segment of the population in the UK and the US. And he's therefore very good at the political market. He is able to leverage fear in such a way as to bend political policy to his ideology, which is a neoconservative one, and to get in whatever prime minister he wants or president. He's not yet quite there in determining the presidency, but he's getting close as he's, you know, he entered the U.S. market a decade or two after his success in altering the political fabric in the U.K.
Mm-hmm.
So he has, in the political market, he is able to, you know, create panic and stampedes, definitely towards a certain policy that he does not want.
Mm-hmm. Right. So he's a propagandist, I guess, is his best, what he does best. And who needs that? I mean, he's a businessman. He's overrated. I mean, stock, I think it's been a big underperformer for decades. And he doesn't seem particularly good at business. He's a good propagandist, though. He knows how to put scantily clad women on page 3 of his newspaper and to appeal to the lowest common denominator, most purient aspects of civilization. Bravo, Murdoch! You are...
That's fine. That's on one level. It's just the fear that is kind of annoying for anybody who isn't subject to fear. But listen, so here's another story this weekend happening right now, today, as you're listening right here to Resonance 104.4 FM in London. This is Max and Stacey on the Truth About Markets. And the Gaza aid flotilla to set sail from Lebanon with all women crew. Yes, an Arab. So they're leaving Lebanon today, I guess, or maybe tomorrow, setting sail for Cyprus. And from Cyprus, they then set sail for Gaza. And you have a very heavily pregnant Arabic singer, I guess. There's a bunch of nuns from America and some doctors, lawyers, and journalists are all setting sail for Gaza again. So that we're heading into Gaza 2.0. It's the next version.
Mm-hmm.
Nuns and pregnant singers.
Well, this is interesting. Obviously, they're sailing into the jaws of a military operation that has already shown that it doesn't hesitate to kill people, as they did on the big flotilla there previously, but the gun people murdered them. So this is what they're heading into.
That's correct. And anybody who, if they do kill these nuns, I think it's 4 nuns from America, you know the media will present it in a different way. Because remember in, I believe it was El Salvador, remember those American nuns raped and murdered there,
mm-hmm,
by the U.S. supported, militias.
Right.
So it wasn't a bad thing. Mm. American nuns don't matter then.
Mm-hmm.
If they're killed by some Taliban, then it's a giant, huge fear mongering campaign that these people are uniquely evil. When, right, our guys kill nuns, it's okay. So, right. And again, like the Taliban or the Iranians, when they stone a pregnant woman, that's bad. But if Israel bombs them, it's not going to be a bad thing. It's their fault for entering the waters.
Right. Now, okay, so Israel's position is that there's a risk that the boat could be bringing in munitions, right?
This is what they're saying, yeah.
That's their fear. Mm-hmm. And so, presumably, on the public relations front, a boat full of nuns takes away this possibility, and it's going to be difficult for Israel to say, well, we were afraid that this boat full of nuns were carrying munitions into Gaza, I believe is the PR strategy here. It seems like a pretty sound strategy. So far, none of these boats have gotten actually to the Gaza unimpeded, right? So
I think there was one before the last Gaza flotilla. I think they did arrive. I recall somebody arriving before, and then the last one got bombed or killed, whatever. But this one, they're bringing nuns and a very heavily pregnant woman, and also they're bringing no cooking or eating utensils at all. So there will be not even a fork on there. They're just going to eat with their hands. There's just going to be no possibility that they're going to be, nothing that can be, that Israel can say that, that pregnant woman and the nun ran after me with a fork and I had to defend myself.
Well, what about some media? Are you able to do vlogging or what have you live? Or is that, you need an actual phone line for that? Or
you need a phone line. And as or a satellite phone or a satellite feed.
Yeah.
There were, on the Gaza flotilla, there were people who were journalists working for networks like Al Jazeera or Press TV, and they did have satellite links until there is a, you know, technology that Israel has which can block that. So they did stop it from recording by the time that they boarded the ship.
Right. And the problem at the end of the day is that Gaza is sitting on basically access to water that Israel wants, right? That's the whole conflict?
It's, I guess, because they democratically elected the wrong people that they don't want. They don't want independent nationalist sort of groups. They want a dependent sort of client state sort of leaders in there. The West Bank is where all the water is that Israel wants, and they've taken it. They have it. They deny Palestinians any access to it other than what is metered and allowed to them. Gaza is just bloody-minded, and they don't like bloody-minded people. Just like America didn't like, bloody-minded Grenadians.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the left bank is where the water access is. Gaza is
the fresh water access, yeah.
Fresh water access. Gaza is. So what about another player in the region, kind of in the news, is Saudi Arabia, the biggest economy in the Middle East, and they are in the news this past week because of their
a rumor that King Abdullah was a thwarted an attempt to overthrow him by some members of. Remember, there was over 5,000 princes. So it's kind of a historic breaking point, you know, when there are too many princes ready to knife the king because they too will be king.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a very dangerous, precarious situation. And of course, it also, you know, they have vast oil wealth and they do have the protectorate of the F-16s and the, you know, the aircraft carriers of the U.S. military.
Mm.
However, you know, they have a growing population of young men under the age of 25. Mm. So that who don't have any access. They're not princes. They're not born into a protected Raj, you know, elect group of princes. So, you could see it coming to a boiling point at some thing. And also their oil is declining rapidly, one would expect.
Yeah, no, well, actually, what I was thinking about was the story about BlackBerry. You know, BlackBerry, the Research in Motion.
Oh, yeah.
Phone, there's come into conflict with the government in Saudi Arabia.
And the UAE, yep.
Yep, because the BlackBerry is impenetrable to government surveillance.
That's remarkable. It's like the freest, the best ad that BlackBerry could receive at this point in time when, you know, many Americans and Brits and Europeans are concerned about their governments collecting so much data and spying on them. And now the UAE and Saudi are banning BlackBerry because they can't monitor their data streams.
Yep. Now, apparently they're talking because the deadline has come and gone, and they're talking about some kind of compromise.
Mm-hmm.
So this will be interesting, whether BlackBerry goes over to the dark side, like Google has now apparently gone over to the dark side with this Verizon deal, but it was a moment there. There was a shining moment where, hey, wow, you mean a BlackBerry? I could actually have free communications without being surveyed upon by the global digital Stasi. Speaking of the Stasi, we finally watched, we'll talk here in the last 10 minutes, we finally watched, caught up with that film that we've been wanting to see for so long.
What is the name of it?
It's called the film that we've been wanting to see for so long.
I'm going to look it up. You keep on talking.
I will. It takes place the year 1984, I guess. And it's a story about
The Lives of Others.
The Lives of Others. The hardest name of a film to remember.
It's Don Lieben der Anderen.
I beg your pardon?
Das Leben der Anderen.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, fantastic film, really. It's about the Stasi, and 4 or 5 years before the Berlin Wall collapses, So the year is 1984, and you see really the Stasi is very much in everybody's life in East Germany, and there's some playwright and writers trying to get out a story across the border to the west, and the Stasi agent tracking them is basically has a change of heart and ends up omitting these stories from the case file, and the anti-East German government story makes it through to Der Spiegel in the West. And but the pacing, the cinematography, the directing, the acting, the story, the scoring, the music, really all just comes together unbelievably well. It's very dramatic, but low-key, slow-burning, but emotionally satisfying film in the end, isn't it?
Yeah, and it captures that thing that you could still see in Berlin if you go to the, you know, the Alexanderplatz, or go along the Berlin Wall, the remnants that are still there, and you do still see, you know, I mean, the West Germans are tearing down and erecting, you know, tearing down the old buildings and erecting, like, well-made German sort of buildings, so you're losing it fast, but you do still see some sense of that bleakness of that, you know, that police state and the suspicion and the terror and the that kind of fake quality to a lot of the intimate interactions, because you're always afraid that somebody's going to be turning you in. But then it's remarkable, and to remember just how fast it all ended, just literally overnight, it just dissolved. The Stasi dissolved, people just disappeared, and it all ended.
Yeah, that's right. It just within a year or two, it just utterly collapsed. And they let everybody into the records, the rooms, and archives, just millions and millions of files. And people were allowed in to examine these files. And the whole thing just collapsed. And then, of course, the whole thing's been reconstructed, hasn't it? Through now the new Pentagon industrial surveillance, NSA, Google, Oracle complex.
Yeah, you definitely feel that now. I mean, when I used to send an email in 1986 or 87, you didn't have a sense of being spied on. You thought there was always a notion that a hacker or a virus could take things, but never your own government sitting there watching and storing every single bit of email. But there is that sort of sense now that every time you write on anything digitally online, you must assume that the government is watching it, no matter how, you know, if you're even just writing to your husband or wife or your mother or your father about what you're going to have for dinner. Every little intimate detail about what you're doing is stored on the NSA database.
Yeah, it reminds me, you know, we had an interesting conversation with an MP or a former MP of the Liberal Democrats who was working in the City of London in the data space. Mm. He's in South Africa. And he was talking about how over a number of years, the transformation to a police state was quite subtle. But what happens is you don't really realize it, but one day you do kind of realize that you don't trust anything that you say is not going to go directly into the central gathering of intelligence. And then he said that's really complete loss of soul at that point. If you're incapable of trusting anyone because of what was going on in South Africa during the apartheid regime, and it leads to everyone is oppressed, not only the people being spied upon, but the people doing the spying, because the people doing the spying are being spied on by other spies who are spied on by other spies. And so you have this just oppressed society where no one is free to communicate at all. And now, I think, in the U.S. and the U.K. around the world, we've gotten to that subtle place where people, when they hit that send button in the back of their mind, they're thinking, well, I have to be careful because this is being read by the authorities.
But it also, you know, bizarrely, about 2 weeks ago, I found a book just lying there on the ground, and it's called Alone in Berlin, and it's here in Paris. I found it, but it's in English. And it talks about also in the 1940, it said, and it's also the same sort of state where the the security forces, the intelligence forces, will kill and torture and put in concentration camps. Also, you know, Germans who were good Germans, the sort, the Aryan sort that they wanted. So there was this sense that they're describing in this book in Alone in Berlin, where what you see in America, what do you get all the time when you say something that you don't like? The number of emails we get from Americans, I'm going to turn you in to the FBI because I myself in my life am helpless and I feel angry and I feel desperate. So I'm going to turn somebody in. And you see this being described in this book from people who were actually survived the whole German experience. And they're saying that it was like this, you know, you were always having to be cautious because no matter everything you had in life could be taken by some angry guy who had lost it all. And he would turn you in just because you looked at him in the wrong way or you failed to say thank you to him.
Yeah, and that's how a lot of the people in Guantanamo Bay ended up there, if you remember.
That's correct.
Local grudges, you know. They went into the region and they said, where's all the bad guys? And then anyone who had a grudge against their neighbor would say, well, he's a bad guy, and then he ended up in Guantanamo.
Yes, and they're guilty without charge. There's no habeas corpus, there's no rights to redress. Because you've been thrown in Guantanamo, you are guilty. And that's what you see with the actual populations. The police state gives angry, grudge-ridden people a lot of power.
Right. And basically to keep the funds flowing in this corrupt surveillance industrial machine that makes folks quite wealthy who are operating the machine, but it completely impoverishes society and it kills the spark of humanity and it just goes down this slippery slope into the abyss. And at some point, there usually is some catalyst to implode the oppressed model. And in this digital situation, it's going to be interesting to see what digital renaissance will occur, where it'll come from, what form it'll take. You know, we see things like Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, or we see what's happening in Iceland with the parliamentarian there who's starting up new areas of protection. I see the U.S. Congress actually mentioned Iceland in particular and said that America should censor Iceland for harboring WikiLeaks and that America needs to take an aggressive stance toward Iceland. This is after American banks eviscerated the economy with weapons of mass financial destruction. After they bankrupted the country, destroyed the currency, destroyed the banks, completely destroyed the country. They want to come back for round two and militaristically, attack the company for having the audacity of supporting free speech and public domain rights.
That's correct. You know, Max, we have only 30 seconds to say goodbye for the next 3 weeks.
Yes.
You want to say a maudlin goodbye?
No, I want to encourage people to spend the next 3 weeks participating on piratemyfilm.com. Yes, piratemyfilm.com is the place you want to be.
And you could also go to maxkaiser.com to see the rest of our material because we will continue doing On the Edges and maxkaiser.com and a Kaiser Report.
Bye, y'all.